I'm sitting with Sasha Gorelick, the founder of Sasha Gorelick Copywriting, a leading Israeli-based media company specializing in Amazon listings. Her expertise is helping Amazon sellers create a strong brand identity, increase conversions with optimized listings and EBC content. She has worked with sellers from all over the world and created hundreds of different product listings. She's an international presenter, having spoken at a European Seller Conference in Prague and Israel Seller Fest Conference. Her client products range from sport rehab products, children's products, and kitchen appliances. In 2005, she made Aliyah from London, England, at the age of 14 with her family. This interview is recorded in Beit Shemesh. Thank you for listening. Sasha, thank you so much for spending a little time with me. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
So can you explain to me, what is an optimized listing and EBC content?
Okay.
That sounds like some terrible disease. What is an EBC content?
Well, it's not, we'll start with the Amazon listing because that is the main part of a product. So on Amazon, what you need to have is obviously like an optimized title so that people can actually find your product when they search for it and it will show up in the search results. Optimized what's called bullet points. And Amazon only gives you a certain amount of characters that you can use to describe your product. And then underneath that is called the product description. So that's my job, is to create the copy that is used to sell the product, to make it sound like, obviously, that's a product that people want to buy, that it's high quality, represent the brand in a really strong way. And with that, you have to also optimize it with keywords, because if there's no keywords in your listing, even if somebody writes you the best copy like in the world, it's not going to sell because it's not going to be found on the Amazon search results. So that's the Amazon listing itself. And then the EBC content is enhanced brand content. And that's for basically when Amazon sellers can get a trademark and they register for what's called the brand registry. And then they have this enhanced brand content, which allows them to add extra photos and text below the listing, which increases conversions by about 10%. So I create the text, and sometimes I help clients like create the layouts, come up with ideas for photos that they can use as well. So
when you're thinking about an Amazon buyer, someone who's looking to buy on Amazon, and you're creating copy for that buyer rather than, say, someone who's doing traditional advertisement through walking through a store, or potentially someone's creating a copy for Facebook targeted ad, can you tell me, like, what are some of the principles that you've seen continuously come up around what a customer on Amazon is looking for and how you optimize for that person?
Right. So it really depends on the product, because if it's, let's say, an electronic product that they've already done, it's like a high ticket item, they've already done a lot of research beforehand. So you don't really need to sell them the benefits. They're more interested in the features, like, does the battery last this long? How much does this laptop weigh? You know, like all the kind of technical answers that they're looking for. But let's say it was a product that's more of an experiential product. So let's say something for kids. So I'm selling them the experience, like I'm selling them how amazing their kids are going to feel, how much their kids are going to learn when they use this product. So you have to really look at the benefit sometimes and sell that to the customer versus like the features of the product. But again, it really does sometimes depend on different types of products, different types of categories. You have to really understand who the target audience is, like what do they actually want and why do they need this product, versus just assuming that you understand your clients and understanding what they want. Because that's a big mistake I think a lot of sellers make, is that they think they already know what their clients want. And you really have to read forums, go on Facebook, and understand what clients need before you start sort of writing what you think.
So yeah. Can you give me like one example of a recent product that you worked with, without obviously saying the name, but how you go through that process? Can you tell me about the life of Sasha Gorelick, expert Amazon writer? Like, what does your life look like? A client reaches out to you.
Right.
What are the questions you ask them, and how does it actually get converted? If you can give a life example of an actual firm, that'd be really sweet.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, I can't really give it details because everything's very private with Amazon sellers, because I don't want anyone to copy the ideas. But what happens is, when a client comes to me,
What do you mean by that? I'm sorry.
A client comes to me?
No.
Oh.
Nobody, they don't want their ideas to be copied.
Because on Amazon, what happens a lot is that people's products get what's called hijacked, or people just copy your exact design and they start selling the exact same product as you. And so people don't want that to happen, obviously.
And then just to clarify, are they also stealing the copy as well?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes, like, you'll have Chinese sellers that will come along and steal your photos, steal your copy and everything, and then you have to complain to Amazon and get them to take it down, and it's a whole long process, which, yeah.
Okay, so basically it just turns in, they would do a search for a product that's selling really well, identify that product,
yeah,
copy your entire copy, copy all the pictures, and then produce that product, say, in a for cheaper.
Quality. Exactly.
Lesser quality or cheaper. And
yeah,
then
sometimes that's what happens. Yeah. So then what a lot of Amazon sellers do is they buy the competition and they take pictures of it and show Amazon that it's a fake. And then Amazon takes the listing down, basically.
Okay. And how frequent is that? I'm just curious.
How frequent? I mean, I'm not sure because I'm not actually an Amazon seller. I just hear about all these things from my clients and from different groups that I'm in. But it happens pretty often, unfortunately. Yeah, it's tough.
Okay, great. That might be our new best idea coming through this podcast is essentially hijacking. So tell us me a little bit about the process. So right. And a client reaches out to you.
So a client reaches out to me. They can fill out a form on my website. And then what happens is next that I need information from them about their product. So I have a whole questionnaire, like a whole intake form, where I ask them questions like, obviously, what's their brand name? What's their USP, which is unique selling point? What makes them better than a competitor?
Do you find
product?
That most clients know those answers to those questions?
A lot of times they do, and many times they really don't. And sometimes they are really selling very similar products. So they ask me to somehow make it sound better and find like a new angle to make the product sound better than other people's. And then I ask them like, what are their brand values? Do they have specific sort of language that they use for their brand? And like people will give me different answers. It really depends because sometimes it's a new seller and they're just literally launching one product. And sometimes I'm working with companies who already have, you know, their products already in retail, like in the US, and like they have their own website, but now they're starting to launch on Amazon because they realize it's another source of traffic that they can bring to their company. So they already have brand guidelines in place and values that they want me to like use within the Amazon listing. So those clients are obviously a lot easier to deal with because they have a very clear vision for their company and for their products. Whereas someone that's very new, that's just manufacturing on their own from China, doesn't really have so much of a clear vision as to where they see their company going.
So just to clarify, so this intake form sounds really important.
Yes.
That's probably one of your competitive advantages is the correct type of intake form.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So is a process that you also charge the client per hour, so therefore the more accurate the intake form is, the easier it is for you to be able to do your job.
Right.
How do you encourage them to be able to actually do their own thinking?
I do charge per project, basically. And obviously, the more information they give me, the more helpful it is and the easier it is for me to write because then I have more information on who their target audience is, more information on their data, more information on who their competitors are. And otherwise, I would have to do all that research myself, which I have done in the past. But I've learned from my mistakes that if the client really gets clear on what they want, then I know what they want and then I produce much better copy at the end of the day.
Sure. Okay, I understand. Now, is there any, if you would say three tips for people who are considering writing copy for Amazon,
mm-hmm.
or alternatively, an Amazon seller who's reaching out to some, who's reaching someone who's a professional copywriter, how do we differentiate the copywriters who are just garbage from the people who actually know what they're doing? What are some signs that they should be looking for?
Well, it's really, there's a lot of competition, and I've differentiated myself by going off of freelance platforms. So I used to be on Upwork and I once opened an account on Fiverr and I realized that there was no way I could really differentiate myself. So that's why I started my own website and really, really honed my
craft.
Why
couldn't you differentiate yourself?
Why? Why could I?
Why could you not?
Oh, why? In those platforms? Because you're just fighting with hundreds of other freelancers who claim that they can do the same job as you for a cheaper price. And I think that the clients that look for copywriters on those platforms are not necessarily looking for quality. They're just looking to get the job done. So when you're looking for like someone that can do copywriting for you, you know, don't try and get the cheapest offer because it usually means that they're not as professional. They're not going to take the time to really do the research about how your product works and, you know, what the competition looks like and all that kind of stuff. So definitely, when you pay a lower price, you know, sometimes you end up paying for it later by having to like redo the work that's already been done. So
how did you differentiate yourself from Fiverr and
Upwork?
Yeah. So how what was the, you started your website and then were you able to more accurately tell your story and the value proposition?
I was more accurately able to bring my value proposition, which was also about using storytelling within product listing because I like to do that. And being creative as well with the work that I do and the angles that the approach I take with clients, because sometimes I give them advice even, like I'll be like, I don't know why you're selling in this category because your product could really fit into a different category in Amazon and there's less competition there. And they're like, oh, I didn't think of that. Like, I didn't think that we could use the product for, I'm just trying to think of an example.
It'll come back to you as soon as you stop thinking about it.
Yeah, probably.
So, it's interesting. So the value added even more, what you're mentioning is that you got this opportunity to, you have seen so many different listings and so many different clients and products that you can even advise the company how to do better in terms of their selling point, right?
Just sometimes, seeing, yeah.
Uh-huh, interesting. And there's a really great interview with Seth Godin, who's one of the marketing experts, and he says that because of this, in a global economy, unless you're the if you're second cheapest,
right,
then it's already a bad business model.
Right.
I mean, there's a value in being the cheapest in something because you can have scale. But I see with going that freelance route of being on Fiverr or Upwork. It just, you're competing against Sri Lanka.
Yes.
Like you compete against always somebody else who's gonna it's competing on price is just not a productive way of going about things.
Not very productive, no.
How were you able to build a brand identity where people realize, okay, I'd rather go with Sasha rather than
So I mean, it's obviously been like a good 2-year process. This whole thing started because I did start on Upwork and I did take the lowest paying jobs because I wanted to get that experience. And I wanted to just get those jobs because I didn't have another job at the time. Like, I was only freelancing. And so, like, the job that I took was actually for $5. And it was...
You were that lady.
I was that lady that did the $5 job. Yes.
Who, I assure you, whenever I see someone that says, I'm from England, I'll do job for $5, I assume that it's a fake picture and a fake profile. But you were actually the lady. You're Sasha Gorelick.
It happened to be the client that hired me was from India, so I don't think they really cared. Wow. That was the funny part.
That's hilarious.
So I worked for that company for a good amount of time, for like a whole year, because they liked the first piece of work that I did for $5. So they were like, oh, well, we want to train you. And so then they hired me off of Upwork, not on the platform. And I ended up doing all their Amazon listings, and they taught me like everything, their whole process for building the listings. And I'm like, wait a minute, like I'm only getting paid like, you know, whatever it was, which was like $10 an hour. $10 an hour is not a lot of money. And I'm like, if I'm that good, then I can do this and get paid more. Mm-hmm. So then I tried to start getting clients on my own, but I don't think I was quite at the level yet to really build my own website. So I ended up actually working for an agency in New York, and they also have an Amazon listings agency.
How did you get connected to the agency? I'm just curious.
So I saw on Facebook, they made a post like, oh, we're looking for writers. So I'm like, oh, I know how to do this. And I contacted them, and then they liked my work that I already had in my portfolio. So they hired me, and they were giving me a ton of work. I was like a factory, just like producing like listing after listing after
it's
listing
after
listing.
It's just baby products. Yeah. That's a baby product.
And
and how much were you getting paid there?
So there I was getting paid like a little more, like probably per hour it worked out about like $20 an hour, $25 an hour.
Which just means like you're the richest woman in Israel.
Apparently.
Yeah, that much money.
But then that wasn't enough. Also I realized that the level of copywriting that I was doing was going down.
Why?
Because they were just giving me so much work, and then the end result, they didn't really care how high quality it was. And I realized that, like, number one, I'm not learning how to become a better copywriter, because all they need is just to get the work done and get it back to their clients, and their clients didn't seem to really care so much about quality. And then number two, I wasn't learning how to make better Amazon listings, because I would ask the agency, like, do you have any data about how my listings help this client get more sales? And they were like, oh, sorry, we don't have any data. And I'm like, well, that's not helping me. So that's when I started getting my own clients.
So you kind of outgrew your own employer.
Yes, exactly. And I realized, like, I could be doing what he's doing, but better.
I think that's a constant theme that I see with entrepreneurs, is that they work at a place and they learn the craft, and they feel like, wait, so these guys are the experts?
Right.
Like, well, you should not be the experts. I think I know it better.
Exactly.
And then you feel confident enough to be able to start their own thing, right? But you had, you know, one of the things that, not turning a little bit to Aliyah and people making Aliyah, the constant theme here is the patience piece.
Yes.
People are not patient.
It does take a lot of time. People are not patient. Yeah.
Like, you started literally, you in Sri Lanka and Nigeria, and you were just there as one of the faces.
Right.
And, like, literally eating dirt for a year.
Yeah.
And then eating, like, maybe better tasting dirt.
Yeah.
For
6 months. Yeah.
Like a Mahadran dirt for like 6 more months. And then you felt like, okay, I have a portfolio,
Right.
How did you manage that patience? How did you get that willpower and stuff? Say, I'm a privileged, I'm an English woman, I'm very proper, like, why am I getting paid so little for my God-given greatness?
Right. I wasn't in the mindset of that I could make more money. Like, my mindset at that point was literally like, I'm a stay-at-home mom. I have like my baby at home, my second kid. And I was like, I just wanted to make a few thousand shekel on the side. But like, slowly, slowly, I kind of grew into my greatness, I guess you could say that. Like, I realized, like, hey, like, I can actually make a business out of this. Like, I can actually make a lot of money doing this. Like, and I am actually really, really good at what I do. And one of the key things that makes me different is that I always put maximum effort into everything that I do. It doesn't matter if I'm getting paid like $5 or if I'm getting paid $500. Like, I put the same amount of effort into it. And that's what allowed me to kind of grow into the place I am today. So
it was that patience came from a place of you had some expectation that initially was a side hustle.
Yeah.
It was basically your primary identity was raising, at that time, raising family. And then we say, see, okay, I'm making money and also could become better in that.
The day I made the switch actually was when I came across someone that did the exact same thing that I was doing. And I was only charging $50 at that point for a listing. And she was charging $400. And I'm like, someone could charge $400 for the same work that I'm doing for $50? This makes no sense. Like, that's when I really started to learn like a lot more about what I was doing and how much money really I could make from it. And not, I also enjoyed doing it. So it wasn't like I was just doing it to make money. I really do enjoy the creative aspect of it. And and working with like entrepreneurs as well. So
one thing we spoke of before, and this really goes back to your ability to do whatever you do, really you do it best, is your love for sports.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your love for sports? What role that play in your life and how that build character for you
as
an entrepreneur? Because I see the consistent theme.
Right. So, I mean, when my family moved to Israel, I was 14. And let's just say school didn't work out so well. And so the only outlet really was going to gymnastics. And so I was training about like 2 or 3 times a week. I was also involved in some women's productions like in Ramat Beit Shemesh. And those things really, really gave me, I guess, just an amazing outlet and made me feel like a lot more confident, I guess, about who I was as a person. Because when you don't have like a good, school or teachers or like, you know, you've kind of lost that support system that we had when we lived in England. So those outlets really helped. And yeah, definitely being in gymnastics and working hard and pushing yourself to do more reps when we're doing push-ups or whatever it was that we were doing. So that, I think, definitely builds a lot of mental strength to like be able to build a business as well. So definitely sports. And also sports just makes you feel so much more energized. So even now when I'm working my business, like last night I went for like a run for like, I don't know, it was like 4K. And I love it. It's like such an amazing outlet. And if I don't move and I don't get out and do exercise, I feel really sluggish, really depressed, really not creative. And just doing exercise is something that really, really helps your brain, I think. Yeah.
Well, that's one of your secret weapons. That's what you tap into. Now, the question that comes up a lot of people ask is this. I mean, one thing that's curious, your parents basically dragged you to Israel, right?
My parents told us we were making Aliyah and we were really excited because we thought we were going on holiday, like permanently on holiday. It didn't really grasp the fact that like, no, we're not going on holiday. We're actually going to live in this country and go to school in this country.
Sure.
And you're leaving your friends behind. So the first year after making Aliyah was actually just, it really was vacation. Me and my sister and like all these other girls that also had just made Aliyah, we had the time of our life. We like went to the beach, we went to town, we got iced coffees every day and we were having a great time.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden it hit that, oh wait, we have to do school and we have to do tests and like who are all these weird people. So it definitely hit hard after all the fun was over. You were like, oh wait, that's it, real life now.
Well, what was the motivation of your parents about making Aliyah?
I mean, my parents.
Was Zionism a big part of your family history?
It really wasn't. Like, they just basically saw more and more sort of anti-Semitic signs on the wall. Like, I mean, even just where we live, there was swastika graffiti.
Where Golders Green? Or?
No, in Edgware.
Edgware, okay.
And, you know, there was always stories about kids getting beat up on the way to school and just all these little things. My parents were just, this is not, you know, the life we really want. And I think my dad also just felt like he was in a rat race, going to work, coming back, paying the school fees. And he didn't have that, you know, he didn't have time to even learn because it was just so tough, I think, with all the expenses. They decided that they would be better off living in Israel, basically.
Wow.
Yeah. But a lot of what I've learned about resilience and everything comes from my parents because I've seen the way that they've pushed through all the hard things they've had to deal with in Israel. And even my dad has started like a bunch of different businesses. Some of them have worked out, some of them haven't, but he always has this huge smile on his face And he always has this trust in Hashem that's just, Hashem will provide for me. Like, I don't need to worry. It's fine. So
what do you think are those characteristics that your father and mother had that, you know, made them unknown and make Aliyah a reality? Like, what would you say, you know, so, as a kid growing up with that family in that home, I come from that place because there's a lot of, the unfortunate reality is most Olim don't make it.
Right.
That most Olim, they come here, they have expectations of what's going, this country is going to look like, and the iced coffee is going to start melting after a little while. And you realize, wait a second, it's rent, and it's our Nona, and it's responsibility, it's right. A language. Like, what would you say were the rules of your father's success?
My parents always say if they knew what they were getting into, they would never have done it.
Really?
So they made Aliyah. We didn't even have a house to live in when we moved here. We went to an absorption center for a few days.
Did you have a lot of financial resources, or you guys were, when you came, it wasn't like comfortable?
It was not comfortable. We didn't have furniture for like a bunch of months until like our lift came.
Uh-huh.
My parents, they didn't even sell their house in England yet because it was just, the market was really bad at the time and they couldn't sell the house. And like, they just did anyway. My parents have always been sort of risk takers and they go against the grain, I would say. Yeah, and they just do things and just kind of trust in Hashem that it will work out for the best. And they, yeah, that's definitely.
So you learned from there, they had a little degree of risk taking. Their faith was obviously very critical.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't necessarily the like Zionism from a secular sense that was what was driving them. That was not the home.
We didn't even like. I mean, even the schools we were in England were more Haredi, and they didn't even celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut or anything. Like, we never really had any connection culturally to Israel at all. It was just the crazy idea they came up with, and then we ended up, coming.
Incredible. And that was it. Incredible. And then you're married to an Ole as well.
I am, right? Yes.
Was that I was going to say, was that by choice? Did your parents force that? That's a really,
it was an arranged marriage.
That's a very dumb question. But was there specific thinking that you had about you want to marry an Ole? Was that something that
it's a funny story. I thought I was going to marry someone who was super Israeli, who'd done the army, who was more Dati Lumi, I guess. And then I met my husband. He was American. He had not done the army, and he wore a black kippah. And guess what? We got married. So
wow.
Yeah, it's a very funny story. And like, thank God, you know, it worked out. And yeah, so he's from America, and he basically he came here for yeshiva and stayed and went to Machon Lev in Jerusalem, which is the Jerusalem College of Technology. And while he was studying there, so that's when we met. And after we got engaged, that's when he officially made Aliyah.
So you basically, he stayed for you, clearly.
Yeah,
wow.
So
you're part of the Nefesh B'Nefesh magic right there. A few last questions I had that were interesting to me, which is, how do you stay balanced, right? I'm not going to mention your age, unless you can say it to yourself.
We can say
but
it
you're not, you're 28.
I'm 28.
You're 28. You have a successful business. You have three kids under the age of
six.
You know, how do you manage to stay focused on what's important and stay productive and balance all these different identities?
Right.
Do you have tools that you practice that are critical for you?
So it's definitely, I can't say I was always so good at balancing. Like, I've been like a workaholic some months because like I've just had so much work and staying on the computer till really late at night, not taking care of myself properly. But more recently, I've realized that that's just not a way to live. Like, it's not going to make me happy, and it's like kind of all just seems meaningless when your whole life is just revolving around your work the whole time. So I've really had to kind of make the switch between being a freelancer and into like a boss. So right now, like, I've hired a bunch of other people to be on my team that I can outsource work to, and I work with them obviously to make sure all the work is up to scratch and gets delivered to the clients in the same standard that it would be if I wrote it myself, basically. And so that's just giving me so much more time because now I can rely on other people and manage other people versus me doing every single thing myself. And so when you're a freelancer, you suddenly realize that you can't just be a freelance writer. You're also managing clients. You're also managing social media. You're also managing accounting. There's a lot that goes into managing a business. So that's why you do need to expand your team. And it was a big deal because I didn't want to relinquish control. I didn't want to let someone else do the work because I was, well, what if they don't do it as good as me? Like, and then what's going to happen? But thank God these writers have been amazing so far that I've been working with.
When you outsource, right, which is that movement from being a freelancer, one-man show, to actually managing and...
Right.
Did you create a manual or did you create a Google Doc that has your process written out?
Right. Like
how did you lay over the map?
So what's great about these writers that I just hired is that they already have experience in doing what I do. So they already know, I send them all the information so that they know exactly what they need to write about. They have all the information that I get from my clients. I send them the photos, they know what the product looks like, et cetera, et cetera. And then afterwards, I actually edit all their work and do all the keyword research myself.
And I'm sorry, I'm actually really glad you brought this back up. Can you go back to keywords? Is that similar to SEO or like SEO. How's keywords different?
Yeah, so it's different because you need to use specific software that's for Amazon that it's not exact data, but it gives you data that comes from Amazon basically, which shows you the number of searches.
What's the name of the software?
There's a lot of different software.
Oh, there's not one proprietor that's going to Amazon.
There's like a whole bunch of different companies.
Do you mind sharing
one of them that I use mainly is Helium 10, it's called, which just has like a huge...
Fascinating name.
I know, right?
Sounds like a really, like a laughing gas.
So it has a lot Helium of different 10. Tools that I can use. So one of them is called Cerebro, which is basically, I know they have these really wacky names. It's a reverse ASIN. Okay, I'm talking Amazon language right now. So reverse ASIN means that you take someone's ASIN, which is like the code that each product gets when you list on Amazon, and you put it into the software, and then it pulls all the keywords that they're indexed for. And you can see which keywords they're indexed for on which page, how many searches per month, whether or not they're running sponsored ads for that keyword, and yeah, all that information.
Got it. So essentially you're able to trace back through this software. This marker.
Yeah.
Back to the most popular keywords associated with that product type.
Right. So something like that, yeah.
Interesting. And then your job is to integrate those keywords, basically.
Yeah.
Awesome. Last question is, what would you say has been professionally your biggest failure? And how has that, looking back at it, has been actually a success for you professionally?
Right. So this is a great question. A few years ago, when I was 22, I think, I tried to start a business, which was an online website for artists, like in Israel. And I spent hours and hours trying to build this thing, hiring freelancers, running around trying to get investors, applying to all these different accelerator programs. And I didn't get into anything, and I was miserable, and I was trying so hard. And then actually I spoke to Mo Murnik, and he gave me some great advice.
Well, shout out to Mo Murnik here.
Shout out to him. He was like, you know what, if something's not working, you need to know when to stop. And that was amazing advice because I was like, you know what, you've tried, it didn't work out like you thought, you know, I took out a loan, which I had to pay back, which is fine, it wasn't like a huge amount of money, it was 20,000 shekel, which is, it's all good. And through that, I was writing a lot of blogs and interviewing a lot of artists, and someone said to me, hey, Sasha, you're like a really good writer, and I was also writing about their products, I was writing descriptions about the different products the artists were selling. Then that basically got me into this whole product description writing.
That was a starting point of the empire.
Yeah, that was a starting point. And it was...
Mo Murnik, everybody.
Yeah. I mean, like, the website itself is shut down. Like, it was lovely, but it didn't make any money. And, yeah, so you have to know when's...
But you had that learning experience.
It was a good learning experience. And thank God my husband has been so supportive. And I'm very stubborn. I'm very strong-minded. So he'll say things to me like, I don't know if that's going to work. I don't know if that's the best idea. And I'll be like, no, I'm going to do that anyway. And then he never says, I told you so afterwards. He's always like, well, you tried and you learned so much from it. And he's always super supportive about everything that I've done. And it's also because of him that I've been able to do all the things and build this business, because he's been working full-time. So meaning we know we have a certain amount of money coming in every month. And I had the time to really, like, grow my business slowly and at my own pace, even though I have, like, young kids at home. So, yeah.
I just realized as you were just finishing up that we didn't complete the thought about balance.
Oh, right. We didn't.
Yeah. We just went to Amazon land
for
a little bit, which is great.
We got lost.
Amazon land is totally...
in the jungle.
So can you just talk through a little bit balance and...
Yeah.
Your realization that it's just much more effective.
So I started taking an amazing boxing class for women, and that, like, hour a week where
by
I just have with Hanania David. Awesome.
My coach. Shout out to Hanania David.
Shout out to Hanania.
A lot of love today from Mom and Hanania. Yeah.
Right. So he's great. And that hour a week of exercise is just so much fun and so great. So just to take that time, because before I started taking a class and paying for a class, I was like, well, yeah, I'm just going to do exercise at home. I didn't actually do it, you know. I mean, I do like small workouts at home, because I work from home, so I can just do handstands in my living room and do push-ups while I'm waiting for the kettle to boil or things like that, because that's just what Sasha does at home because she's crazy. And so the balance of making time for the things you love to do and not necessarily chasing after the money, because the money will come, I think, when you yourself are happy with who you are and you feel fulfilled as well. And that was, that's definitely a huge lesson, is that, like, you really do need to, like, make time to also listen to Shirim. Like, I've been trying to do that more lately, read more Torah thoughts and not necessarily always just read business blogs, because that's what I do a lot. So, yeah, definitely you just have to, really be disciplined, I think, about making time for the other things. And then when it's time to be with my kids, so, like, switching off, well, I don't actually switch off my phone, but I try not to look at my phone as much between, like, let's say 3 and 7 when the kids are home and I'm with them and I'm taking them to the park, and I am definitely, I think, fully there with them and focused on them. So that's basically the balance, I guess.
And is there a last piece of advice or a thought you want to share with people who are listening? That's one. And the second thing is, how can we as a community help you? Because that's one thing that I'm learning more and more to ask of the community, is that, is there something that, first, again, any last piece of advice that you think is worthwhile? And the second thing I just want to ask you, is there either a certain challenge or an opportunity in your business or a mentor that you're looking for? You say, like, I wish I could speak to this person in this country, and this is his name, and whoever can find me that person. And I've been able to see a lot of success. Ironically enough, from this podcast,
so funny.
People say, I want to, find a supplier of organic grain in Ukraine. I'm like, okay, and then and a week later, you have a person who's...
That's really funny.
So I want to be very... very clear about those two things.
I mean, the one person I would love to speak to is Seth Godin, because I'm, like, obsessed with his books and everything. I don't know if that's ever going to happen, Alex. I mean, if you could make that happen, that would be
impressive.
Very impressive.
Okay.
Or Marie Folio, because I love her channel also.
Who's Marie Folio?
She's, like, a business and life coach. She has, like, a big YouTube channel. And I just, like, watch her stuff because I think it's really great. It's very inspirational. She has some really, really good talks with people, so I like to watch that. Find that very inspirational. In terms of things I need right now, I think I'm good. Like, thank God. Like, I've had some really good advice from people, from Facebook, from this Ima Kadima group that I'm in, from...
That's Nava Shafter.
Yeah.
That's a friend of mine.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, there's... I feel like a good piece of advice is that you don't necessarily need to, like, pay a lot of money to coaches or courses or things. There's so much you can learn on your own. You just have to be disciplined enough to do it. Because people always ask me, oh, who taught you how to do keyword research? Who taught you how to do Amazon writing? Like, did I go to school for this? Like, did I take a course? And the answer is no. I never took any courses. Like, I went to school for social sciences, of all things. And no one taught me anything. I taught myself, and I had the persistence to keep learning and keep getting better at what I do. And being able to also take criticism or feedback from clients. I mean, most of my clients have always been really, really happy with my work, which is great. But definitely, like, seeing how they do things and learning from the businesses that I've worked with has also been really, very
amazing.
Helpful. So.
Well, thank you for sharing your wisdom. And Seth Godin, and what's the other woman's name?
Marie Folio.
Marie Folio. We're putting it out there in the universe to see what we're going to be attracted back. And,
maybe.
For all the kindness and good you're doing for us. So thank you so much for letting us learn from you.
All right.
And obviously, anyone who's... Any company that's selling, what would you say? What's the revenue of a company for the Amazon that would use your services? So what would you say?
Anyone that's even doing 10K a month could use my services, because the difference between a well-optimized listing and a not well-optimized listing is the difference between, like, a good few $100,000 in sales at the end of the year. So you definitely want to make sure that that's done properly. So
perfect. Okay. So that for sure will be easily taken care of.